ticklish business any way you look at it. Come on, we'll stick together.
It's Ticklish Business, the podcast devoted to honoring and deconstructing the world of classic cinema. As always, I'm your host, Kristen Lopez. On this week's episode, I'll be talking with Jacob Haller about Stanley Kubrick's 1956 noir, The Killing. The third feature film by director Stanley Kubrick, The Killing follows a group of robbers attempting to pull off the biggest racetrack heist in history. Told in a non-linear fashion, the film follows a rather methodical pace as the group of thugs plan and execute the heist, but complications obviously ensue when outsiders learn of the plan alongside a general breakdown that results in things going dangerously awry. You actually have a really great all-star cast of B-movie stars here, with the gruff Sterling Hayden being the film's biggest name. Other stars include Nightmare Alley's Colleen Gray, actually celebrating her birthday this month, the phenomenal character actor Elisha Cook Jr., and the Queen of the Bees herself, Marie Windsor. It's also worth mentioning that the film's central set is actually the Bay Meadows Racetrack in San Mateo, which is about 2.5 hours away from me. Unfortunately, though, you can't go visit the set yourself because the location closed in 2008.
Give or take a few thousand. I figure the loot on this deal at $2 million.
There should be that much in the track offices.
You like money. You got a great big dollar sign there where most women have a heart. So play it smart. Stay in character and you'll have money. Plenty of it. George will have it. He'll blow it all on you.
Johnny, I'm no good for anybody else. I'm not pretty and I'm not very smart, so please don't leave me alone anymore.
You think or know that you're going to have several $100,000?
Because I do. I just can't talk about it, that's all.
Not even to me, your little share.
I shouldn't have even mentioned I was going to have it. It's not that I mind. I know I can trust you. But if these other guys
these
ever...
These other guys?
I can't talk about it, Cherry.
You've been talking. Now you spilled to her.
Oh, I didn't honest. What, do you think I'm crazy? I wouldn't
jerk you, clown!
Let's get some history. The Killing was the result of a chance meeting during a game of chess between Stanley Kubrick and producer James B. Harris, which is ironic considering how the film's plot actually involves a chess game at one point. Harris was looking for young talent, and, entranced by Kubrick, the two formed the Harris-Kubrick Pictures Corporation. The two decided to purchase the rights to Lionel White's potboiler Clean Break, which was being eyed by United Artists for star Frank Sinatra. Kubrick enlisted pulp writer Jim Thompson, who helmed fantastic works like The Grifters and The Killer Inside Me, to write the authentic-sounding noirish dialogue. Star Sterling Hayden took a reduced fee to star as lead gangster Johnny Clay, while Kubrick himself took no money to direct. But United Artists, who decided to finance the picture, lacked faith in the project, which led to reduced funding, forced narration, and Kubrick having to recut the film in a linear style, all of which he did very, very begrudgingly. Filmed in just 24 days, The Killing ended up as the second feature on a double bill with Richard Fleischer's Bandido, so it's no surprise that it was a box office flop that barely traveled the US. However, the critical acclaim was massive in spite of the dismal returns. Hollywood took notice of Kubrick, with MGM's Dori Sherry offering Harris and Kubrick $75,000 to write, direct, and produce Kirk Douglas's Paths of Glory. Douglas and Kubrick worked again the next year on Spartacus. Harris and Kubrick worked on two more features as a production company, the aforementioned Paths of Glory and Lolita. Since then, The Killing's acclaim has only grown, like its director's career, with Roger Ebert and Peter Bogdanovich calling it an essential film. Quentin Tarantino has cited The Killing as a major influence in his work, with parallels seen in both Pulp Fiction and Reservoir Dogs.
You mean there's gonna be two other guys in on the deal, and we ain't gonna know who they are?
That's right. You don't know who they are, and they don't know who you are. That makes sense to you, doesn't it?
Well, yes, I guess so, but I...
Makes sense to me, all right. How come we need them, though, Johnny? What are they gonna do?
One of them's for the job with a rifle. None of you boys can handle that, even if you were willing to. And the other one starts the fight in the bar.
These other fellas, how much are they cutting in for? Not that I mind. Anything you do is okay, but...
These men are not gonna be in on the basic scheme. They're getting paid to perform certain definite duties at a certain definite time, and they're not cutting in on the take. They'll be paid a flat price to do a straight job.
Well, if they don't know anything about the basic plan, about the job, then why are they doing it?
That's simple. These boys are straight hoods. They get paid in advance, $5,000 for the one with the rifle and $2,500 for the other.
Well, where's this money coming from?
That's where Marvin comes in. He's getting the $7,500 for us, and he gets it back off the top.
I wish I could do more, Johnny. It's almost not right for me to get as much as everybody else. After all I do is...
Your money counts for plenty, Marv. You don't hear any of them complaining, do you?
Sure, you're okay in our book, Marv. But look, Johnny, if these two hoods get paid in advance, how do you know they're going to do their jobs?
I'll vouch for them. These guys are pros. They can't afford to weasel out on a deal. If they did, they'd be washed up. Okay?
Okay.
Any other questions?
So today I'm talking with Jacob Haller. Jacob, how are you?
I'm doing great. How are you?
I'm great. Why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself?
So I live in Providence, Rhode Island. I'm a musician, and then I also have a couple of podcasts myself, one that's music-based called Tell Me About Your Song, where I talk to songwriters about a song they wrote, and another called Love You Like Crazy, or Love YA Like Crazy, where I talk to my friend Carrie, who lives in North Carolina, about young adult fiction.
And you selected The Killing. Why did you pick it, and what is it about the film that's so appealing to you?
Well, it's kind of interesting to me, partly because it's a Stanley Kubrick movie, but I feel like it's a little bit a Kubrick movie before he was Stanley Kubrick. He's kind of working within his studio system. You know, these are all actors that I feel like pretty recognizable from other roles. He's working with another writer and apparently a cinematographer who he had a lot of disagreements with, and he's working within kind of this established genre of the caper story. Interesting to see him in this earlier period kind of coming into his own sort of power as a filmmaker, if that makes sense. Sterling Hayden, I think, is great. I haven't seen too much other early Kubrick. One of the movies before this was Killer's Kiss, which is a movie where he's still kind of figuring out how to put his stamp on the movie. So there are some great parts, and then there are other parts that are more standard.
I had never actually heard of this until you had suggested it, and I did some background on it and discovered Kubrick's name and all of that. So I figured, okay, I'll give this a try. Because my Kubrick experience, I would say if I had to go the earliest film in terms of his chronology that I've watched, it would be Lolita. And Lolita is a totally different film from this, not just obviously narratively, but technically the way Kubrick plays with tone. And this is very much, if I did not know Kubrick's name was associated with it, I probably wouldn't have ever guessed that this was a film that he had worked on. We should bring up, I mean, I don't know how much you know about kind of the crime film in the 1915, kind of the heyday of noir in the 40s, and the crime film had kind of changed from the 1930s. It was all about glorifying the criminals, something like Public Enemy or Scarface. As the code, the motion picture code, took over, law and order was established, which is why you get a lot of those 1940s tales of the FBI or G-Men, where it was the heroes were not the villains. And as the 50s progressed, you got a lot of films that I think tried to play with those techniques. This has a very contained story, even though it takes place, obviously characters leave their house. It's a very small-scale, almost kind of stage-based type of film where it's a small core of characters and how they interact and things change. And they mentioned a puzzle piece, and you're watching how everything is really deliberately parceled out. And having watched a lot of Kubrick films since, that seems very much within his wheelhouse. One of the things that I always notice about 1950s, 1940s crime dramas is narration.
Yes.
Which this movie has in abundance. Kubrick did not want narration because he felt that it was very easy to deduce. Part of the mystery is the fact that this is a non-linear story. And they actually did recut this in a linear fashion, and it bombed. And they ended up re-releasing it with the way it is now. But the narration is supposed to, quote-unquote, make it easier for people to understand. And that was very much popular during the time period because it gave it a documentary feel. You know, a lot of crime movies like to put narration because it was that ripped from the headlines true life event. And I guess that was also what they might have been going for. I don't necessarily think it works, if only to confuse people more.
Yeah, like they're just tossing around a lot of times and dates. I think that there are two things that it says happen at 7 a.m., which can't be happening at the same time. And the narration, I definitely find a little off-putting in general. You know, the last time I watched it, I was just trying to think, like, if the narration wasn't there, would I be able to tell what was going on? And I mean, I think it would have taken some time to get used to. They would have been able to. I don't think it's actually necessary. Kubrick was right about that, but I guess not at a level yet where he could insist on that kind of thing.
We know that Kubrick is not a director who was about holding the audience's hand. He was very much interested in kind of throwing them into the deep end. So you have this this hard-boiled, pulpy, noirish story, and then you get this narration that sounds like you're watching an episode of Peter Gunn or Dragnet that just is so at odds with what we're presented with.
Totally, like the same kind of narration you would find in like an Ed Wood movie or something. Like, it's really not...
Yeah, it's very much that kind of stock, you know, 1055 or 54 went to... It's a cheesy, almost radio-esque insert that might have worked if Kubrick was going for that light satirical tone that, again, seeing something like Lolita, you can just tell it's very much a slapped added in element that he wasn't... I think we should talk about the actual mystery of this movie, because they mentioned in the introduction that it's like a puzzle where you're watching each of the characters essentially shape how things go. And the final 20 minutes of this movie are tense because I was waiting for something, the other shoe to drop.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that comes along with the character who goes to retract the horse. That's his job, Nicky, played by Timothy Carey. And he's had this nice little friendship back and forth with the attendant at the racetrack, who is a black man. And you're waiting for something to go wrong, because guy keeps coming back. He keeps popping back up in this movie as kind of the one person of color in this film to be a nice guy. And everything, I think, explodes with the one use of the N-word.
Yeah.
That Nicky has to say to get rid of him so that he can commit his part of the crime. But as soon as that happens, A, you're taken aback because it's 1956, and I don't know if I can think of another movie before this where I had heard that word. And B, you know that it's going to essentially lead into something going horribly wrong. So I think it's smart on Kubrick's part to make racism kind of the earthquake that undoes the house of cards.
Because that character takes a shine to Nicky, basically, because Nicky has been treating him with respect, kind of interacting with
him. He also tells him that he's a war hero. He's kind of got that story that he's paraplegic. The guy takes pity on him because he thinks he's disabled.
Yeah, and he feels like a little bad that he was kind of harsh with him at first and wouldn't let him park where he wanted to. You know, I wasn't alive when this movie was released originally, but, you know, certainly to modern ears, it's kind of a shocking moment. And it's the way that it's played within the movie. I think it must have been at least somewhat back then, too. Just a sign like, okay, well, that's taking it to kind of a new level that is really not all right. Somehow that horseshoe that the guy was going to give him ends up lodged in the wheel of his car, so he can't get away.
It's also funny, I think the horse takes his revenge, too, because it's a horseshoe that undoes him. You bring up a good point. I'd love to hear how audiences responded to that, because in 56, we were still very much in the Jim Crow South. We had seen films play fast and loose with blackface, and this is a movie that doesn't draw attention to the fact that it's got any type of message, but when Nicky says that word, you're kind of taken aback, and I don't necessarily think it has to do with our modern sensibilities of how we deal with racism. It also is very much like Kubrick is slyly saying, you should be offended by this. Not only does it totally act as the catalyst for the downfall of these characters, but it's a sly little insert of social commentary that plays upon the fact that by 1956 we were still dealing with racism, and that wouldn't be alleviated until the next decade.
Yeah, between that and the kind of mixed up timeline, I was like, how many times did Quentin Tarantino watch this movie? Because
Tarantino has cited this as an influence on his film, and you can definitely see the shades of Pulp Fiction and Reservoir Dogs. Reservoir Dogs, more than any other, mm-hmm. I think, is in here with the gang of thugs, and they all have different elements. I think the fact that only certain people know certain things, that's very much what Tarantino has employed in his films, and obviously the non-linear storytelling. So it was definitely fun for me to kind of go back to that origin and see what Tarantino is lovingly homaging or outright stealing if you're not a Tarantino fan. think it's worth bringing up, too, you know, I don't know how well-versed you are in other noirs of the time period, but this is a gritty type of film. It's a brief, like, I think, what, hour and 24 minutes?
Yeah, it's something like that.
So much is packed into a very small little casing.
Different characters, and they all pretty much, you get to know pretty much all of them, I would say. Even the small parts. Oh, Maurice. You know, like he's just in a couple scenes, but he's given like a couple of big lines and interacts with a few different characters, and you just kind of get to know and like that guy.
And we get Rodney Dangerfield in a little brief cameo.
That's right.
Let's talk about the different relationships in here, because it's surprising to find a noir crime caper film that is kind of loaded with so many character dynamics. And I think the love triangles here are worth bringing up. We have the most obvious one, which is Sherry, played by Marie Windsor, her husband George, played by Elisha Cook Jr., and her lover Val, played by Vince Edwards. That kind of drives the main thrust of the narrative, because she's two-timing her husband, she's going to leave him for this hot young guy, and I love Maria Windsor in this movie. I've loved her in The Narrow Margin. If you haven't seen that, everybody should watch that, because it's an amazing film. But I wanted to see more of her kind of manipulating Elisha Cook Jr., because he's such a sad sack in this movie.
Yeah, I watched this film with my mother, and she said like one of her favorite things in the movie was kind of his character development from this kind of milquetoast guy. She totally twists him around until he finally breaks.
Yeah, he's pretty much this little sad guy, and Elisha Cook Jr. usually always played that type of... But when she starts alluding to rape, and kind of applies that maybe Johnny, Sterling Hayden's Johnny, had his way with her, you just see the light in his, like, head just burst.
Completely spills the beans to her, and he obviously is planning to kill Johnny. After that point, he takes the gun with him.
Which is ironic, because he doesn't at the end.
No, he kills Val. It's a little...
He kills his wife.
Yeah. It's a little confusing as to who kills who in that scene, but he definitely takes out at least a couple people and then goes home and shoots his wife.
You brought up an interesting thing. I know I had mentioned, if you listeners listened to the Ben-Hur podcast, I was the only one who noticed any homoeroticism in Ben-Hur. But you brought up kind of the weird dynamics between Johnny, his girlfriend Faye, played by Colleen Gray, and his friendship with Unger, who is played by J.C. Flippin. Kind of brought up that there might have been a little romanticism there, which I totally noticed.
Yeah, he's kind of bashful when he comes in after Johnny and Faye have obviously just had sex in his apartment at the beginning. But then there's this scene towards the end where Johnny's talking about how, you know, well, we're probably never going to see each other again. Are you really sure that you...
He says that they could go away together or something.
Yeah.
Just be two dudes on vacation.
Right, and maybe you don't actually want to marry this woman. You don't want to rush into something like that. Which I think he goes along with this whole scheme, but the one part that he thinks is a little off is that Johnny and Kay might get married.
You can rob a racetrack, but just don't marry a lady. You know, you don't really need to do that. That's just too out there, apparently.
Right, and then he shows up at the racetrack drunk, which is one of the things that shows that things are not quite going according to plan.
As soon as I saw that they were, I think he says, you know, something, I'd do anything for you, Johnny. It's just, it takes that turn, and I was starting to wonder if maybe there was something there, and then when they have that long conversation about how he treats him like a son, and they could go off together and do whatever. This is one of those movies where I wanted a little more explanation. Obviously, on that front, it would be limited due to the time period, but you brought up a great point. That even though this is 1956, the studio system wouldn't start crumbling until about 63, this movie's kind of sexually charged. You know, we open with Johnny and Faye, and they've obviously had premarital relations. There's that really intimate moment where he's putting her belt on her, which again, when in 1960, when Psycho had a similar scene, people were up in arms over that. So it's a good thing, I guess, that this movie was a box office bomb, because nobody noticed
it.
But you also have Sherry and Val. They have, again, it's very open about the fact that they're obviously not getting together for a nightcap. They're doing some other stuff. That's where you get that Jim Thompson kind of dialogue. And this isn't the 1950s that we've come to identify. This is very much, people were doing pretty much exactly what they were probably doing in 2016.
Yeah, no, absolutely. She accuses him of sleeping around. He's like, well, yeah, I mean, you're married, so like what what exactly are you expecting from this?
You gotta love logic and rationalizing in these types of movies. The dialogue here is written Jim Thompson, who was a pulp writer during the time period. He wrote a lot of amazing kind of pulpy noir books that were filled with sex and violence, which is probably explains a lot of what's going on here. The dialogue feels very authentic when they're plotting, and there's not that weird, you know, 1950s dropping of words that would immediately date it. It's very much a timeless type of film from the dialogue to how things play out. I'm not saying they should remake it, but they could with very few changes because there's not a lot of reliance on technology or anything like that, and the dialogue feels very fresh.
There's some really great lines in it, like the whole thing where when Johnny's talking to Nikki, selling him on this idea of this whole scheme, and he's like, you know, and what are they going to charge you with? It's not murder. I don't know what it is. The worst they could do is maybe inciting a riot or shooting a horse out of season, you know, like that stuff is really great. In the dialogue between George and Sherry, like, she is just always so mean to, like, everything she says, it has a little bit of an edge to it, and it's smart and witty and also just totally merciless to him in this way that's interesting. When he's trying to tell her the story of this couple that he saw on the train, and she just won't have any of it.
Everything is interrupting him and telling him to get to the point. He can't have a nice conversation with his wife. She has to keep talking over him.
So what did you think about this? So there's a scene toward the end where she says, "Do you have the money? I won't have to worry about all this stuff that I'm worrying about currently, and I'll be able to just, you know, your problems will be mine. I won't be thinking about myself as much," which that's obviously not true at all. She sold me on it a little bit.
I think that's the power of Marie Windsor.
Yeah, I guess that's it.
Yeah, she was never a big star. I think is probably best known for maybe this and Narrow Margin and maybe one or two other films. Because I think she's not a glamazon. She's not a Colleen Gray.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, she's very much got that ability to say, hey, you know, I'm just thinking of you. And even though I know I'm acknowledging my fault, you know, she acknowledges that, you know, she's imperfect. She's very the mistress of manipulation.
Yeah.
And the way she has that ability to go from telling Elisha Cook Jr., you know, nothing happened. You know, you're putting words in my mouth and you're implying these things that you want to be true, which is true because he does, I think, act like he wants things to be a certain way. And you know that he wouldn't believe her if she's telling the truth or if she's lying because he doesn't trust her. But when she is caught snooping and she pretends to be, you know, she's passed out and she wakes up and she's got this smile on her face and she's trying to seduce Johnny. She's a woman of many faces.
Yeah, that's definitely true.
Let's bring up Colleen Gray, the only other significant female. And you did mention that it was her birthday, which I think would have been great if she had a bigger role in this. She's kind of negligible. What did you think?
Well, I think that's, I mean, she's not in the bulk of the movie. She's in it a little bit at the beginning, right. And then she has a longer part at the end where she has virtually no dialogue. And in the beginning, she's given this big, long, hunking piece of dialogue that has a bunch of different mood changes in it. And I'm not really sure that scene works that great. But at the end, when she's just reacting to what's going on around her, and she sees the woman with the dog, and it's kind of funny, and the whole interaction at the ticket counter, which is my favorite scene in the whole movie, in which someone who was a lesser actress could really have hurt that scene. And I think she does a great job with it, even though she doesn't have a line for most of it. And her first line in that whole part is, "Taxi."
Yeah, she's got this very long speech that's about how much she loves him and how she's willing to do anything for him. It's almost kind of a groveling type of speech.
Yeah.
The role of women in this movie is not great. You could probably make quite an argument for that throughout a lot of Kubrick's films, because you get the nice girl and you get the thieving shrew. It's not detrimental to the plot, but because this is so tight of a story, calling Gray just kind of seems superfluous. Murray Windsor has a part in the film and how things play out. But poor Colleen Gray just kind of represents very much something like an out of the past. Mm. She represents normality and domesticity that obviously Johnny's never going to be able to have. I did want to ask, mention briefly that the linear versus non-linear. They recut this and put it in order originally, and it didn't get audiences any more pumped towards the film. I mean, can you even fathom this in a linear fashion?
It would be hard. No, I think that this is generally, in watching the movie, I think for the first time and even on rewatchings, I feel like it takes a while to get going, kind of in a way. But eventually, like, all these kind of converging timelines eventually give it this big boost of momentum, so that when you get to the point where you keep seeing the same, which is signposted very strongly, the beginning of the seventh race, which you see several times using the exact same footage, and then you also hear announced in various ways. And then you're like, okay, we're here. This is happening. And it would be hard to get that effect by arranging everything in order. I'm not sure how that would work.
I think that it works just fine, non-linear. I can't fathom it being any better as a linear story. I know they've, like, reconfigured Memento to play out in a linear fashion, and it's a totally different experience from what I've heard. But something like this, I think part of it is that the reason that it endures to this day is that you're never privy to, much like the characters, you're only privy to certain information as it's happening. And we can go back in time, but it always feels kind of like we're getting second or third hand information. For the majority of the film, you're watching things almost as if they're happening as you're learning about them. There's no ability to telegraph the end, other than the fact that you know that it's probably not going to work out because it's 1956 and you can't let the good guys win. But other than that, I was never able to predict what was happening because you're only given information when the director wants you to know it.
Right.
Well, let's talk about the ending briefly, okay, because I think that the ending is so heartbreaking because not only does Johnny not win at the end, which again, you knew because of the time period.
Sure.
I felt it was just such a waste. You know, you watch him losing the money, but then that money just kind of floats out on the breeze. So I was sitting there thinking, does nobody want to pick this up? Why are we not racing for the luggage? So for me, I was just kind of like, it's a waste on so many
levels.
That's
such a long shot, too. They just,
yes,
they just hold on the money swirling around in the breeze from this plane for so long.
Yeah, I didn't care whether what happened at that point. I was just shocked by the fact that nobody's noticing that there's bills flying through the air and nobody's rushing to pick it up.
Yeah, I mean, I guess the guards are keeping the passengers away, but you would notice that suddenly there are all these $100 bills all over the place.
What do you think about the end? Because you've mentioned that you have a lot to bring up about the ending. So.
Yeah, one of the ways the tension is increased throughout the part of the movie, starting with the heist, is that all these things that don't go quite according to plan, like Unger showing up when he's not supposed to. Another great part is when the cop is going off to take part of his part of the plan, and this woman comes out and actually tries to report a crime, and he just drives away.
That's some great Kubrick-style humor,
yeah,
right there.
All these things sort of start going wrong, and then ultimately it leads to Johnny ending up with all $2 million, which, taking into account inflation, is probably around $8,000, or $18 million, rather, in today's money. So he's got like five times as much money as he was originally planned. So he has to stop and get a larger piece of luggage to put it all in. He goes to the airport and he goes to the ticket counter and wants to check it. And it's like this kind of, you know, I work in technical support. My read of that scene is that ticket counter guy and his manager, like, know that something fishy is going, but they don't really care. Like, it might just be that he's got something embarrassing in the suitcase that isn't necessarily illegal, but they just are so polite and completely shut him down, so that Johnny is just kind of awestruck. He and Faye kind of pulls back in, and they walk by, and the people at the ticket counter get the word that $2 million in $100 bills flowing around the runway. They go tell the security guards, and Faye and Johnny go out, and they try to hail a cab, or Faye does. Johnny is just like, at this point, is completely checked out, I would say. And Faye's like, Johnny, you have to run, kind of indicating that she's going to take the heat. And he says, what's the point?
It's very much reminiscent of Double Indemnity, almost. Mm. He knows his goose is cooked.
Right. At this point, it's just delaying the inevitable.
Exactly.
And at the beginning, he had talked about, like, you know, you go to jail the same either way. So once the plan is down the tubes, you know, he's just done.
It's an ending that you expect, but it's very casually presented. There's no grand overarching elements. There's no big moral at the end. It's just, it is what it is.
Right. But, like, I mean, you know, like, if it were a Tarantino movie, you would basically, everyone would get shot, probably, right?
Yeah, you'd have a big bucket of blood. It's surprising that two or three. How many people end up dying in this movie?
Oh, yeah, a ton.
We know Val. Right. We know Nikki. We know Cherry. I mean, there's at least, you know, five or six people dead by the end of this film.
It's probably more than that. All of the conspirators, so.
It's got that Reservoir Dogs ending that we know and love, so to speak, where we don't have a bloodbath by the end, but it's definitely, everybody's gobbins.
All the characters that we get to know are criminals, and some of them we like and some of them we don't. Johnny and Kay and Unger. So I don't know exactly what the morality of a movie like this is.
You know, none of the characters as we know them, because we're not really privy to a lot of history other than maybe Sherry and George's marriage, but we don't really know anybody else enough to determine whether they're good or bad. Yeah, other than the fact that they're robbing this racetrack, for all we know, Johnny could have a family or something that he's, you know, left behind or something. And I think that that works because you're presenting these characters free of any extraneous history.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, you're never really certain whether you're supposed to like them or not. I did want them to succeed because I think that's what works to Kubrick's effect. There's no snarling bad guy who definitely needs to die by the end of this. It's just, these are a bunch of people who obviously see an opportunity and they want to take it.
You know, I think that the only person who gets exactly what they thought they were going to get out of it is Maurice. He gets his $2,500 in advance.
He gets to slap some people around and
get his shirt torn off.
Exactly, which I don't, again, if you're a long-time listener to the last, like, five episodes, you know that I'm not necessarily keen on people being half-naked that don't need to be, and that was, again, another scene where I don't necessarily know if that guy needed to have no shirt on, but...
Well, you know, maybe some people like super hairy shoulders.
Let me know what you think about Stanley Kubrick's The Killing. You can email your thoughts to ticklishbiz@gmail.com, and I'll read them on the next episode. Jacob, I would so like to thank you for joining me today.
Well, thank you. I had a great time watching the movie again, and it's been really fun to talk to you about it.
But once again, where can fans find and get in touch with you if they want to learn more about your podcast and everything?
Probably the simplest thing right now is just, I have a website at jacobhaller.com, which has links to my music and my podcasts and other projects. So just go to jacobhaller, HALLER.com, and you can find all that stuff.
That's going to close out this week's edition of Ticklish Business. You can listen to Ticklish Business a multitude of ways, either at ticklishbusiness.podbean.com, via Stitcher Radio, or on iTunes. If you listen via iTunes, please feel free to leave a rating and review. As always, you can contact me directly at ticklishbiz, that's B-I-Z, at gmail.com, or visit me at my official website, where I discuss classic films regularly, journeysinclassicfilm.com. The podcast is also on Twitter at ticklish_biz. Next time, you'll be getting an extra dose of Ticklish Business next Wednesday, because I am sitting down with Madeline Kahn biographer William Madison. Until then...